Disc 10.
Chapter 112.
You better know what the hell you're doing, Director, Jabba hissed. We're about to lose shutdown capability.
Fontaine did not respond. As if on cue, the door at the back of the control room opened, and Midge came dashing in. She arrived breathless at the podium.
Director, the switchboard is patching it through right now.
Fontaine turned expectantly toward the screen on the front wall. 15 seconds later, the screen crackled to life. The image on screen was snowy and stilted at first, and gradually grew sharper. It was a quick-time digital transmission, only 5 frames per second. The image revealed 2 men. One was pale with a buzz cut, the other a blonde All-American. They were seated facing the camera like 2 newscasters waiting to go on the air.
What the hell is this?
Jabba demanded. Sit tight, Fontaine ordered. The men appeared to be inside a van of some sort. Electronic cabling hung all around them. The audio connection crackled to life. Suddenly, there was background noise.
Inbound audio, a technician called from behind them. 5 seconds till two-way.
Who are they? Brinkerhoff asked uneasily.
I in the sky, Fontaine replied, gazing up at the 2 men he had sent to Spain. It had been a necessary precaution. Fontaine had believed in almost every aspect of Strathmore's plan. The regrettable but necessary removal of Ensai Tankato. Rewriting Digital Fortress. It was all solid. But there was one thing that made Fontaine nervous. The use of Hulahot. Hulahot was skilled, but he was a mercenary. Was he trustworthy? Would he take the passkey for himself?
Fontaine wanted Hulahot covered, just in case, and he had taken the requisite measures. Chapter 113.
Absolutely not, the man with the buzz cut yelled into the camera. We have orders. We report to Director Leland Fontaine and Leland Fontaine only.
Fontaine looked mildly amused.
You don't know who I am, do you?
Doesn't matter, does it? The blonde fired hotly.
Let me explain, Fontaine interjected. Let me explain something right now.
Seconds later, the 2 men were red-faced, spilling their guts to the director of the National Security Agency.
Director? The blonde stammered. I'm Agent Colliander. This is Agent Smith.
Fine, Fontaine said. Just brief us.
At the back of the room, Susan Fletcher sat and fought the suffocating loneliness that pressed down around her. Eyes closed, and ears ringing, she wept. Her body had gone numb. The mayhem in the control room faded to a dull murmur. The gathering on the podium listened, restless, as Agent Smith began his briefing.
On your orders, Director, Smith began. We've been here in Seville for 2 days, trailing Mr. Ensai Tankato.
Tell me about the kill, Fontaine said impatiently.
Smith nodded.
We observed from inside the van at about 50 meters. The kill was smooth. Hulahot was obviously a pro. But afterward, his directive went awry. Company arrived. Hulahot never got the item.
Fontaine nodded. The agents had contacted him in South America with news that something had gone wrong, so Fontaine had cut his trip short. Colliander took over.
We stayed with Hulahot as you ordered, but he never made a move for the morgue. Instead, he picked up the trail of some other guy. Looked private. Coat and tie.
Private?
Fontaine mused. It sounded like a Strathmore play, wisely keeping the NSA out of it.
FTP filters failing, a technician called out.
We need the item, Fontaine pressed. Where is Hulahot now?
Smith looked over his shoulder.
Well, he's with us, sir.
Fontaine exhaled.
Where?
It was the best news he'd heard all day. Smith reached toward the lens to make an adjustment. The camera swept across the inside of the van to reveal 2 limp bodies propped against the back wall. Both were motionless. One was a large man with twisted wire-rimmed glasses. The other was young with a shock of dark hair and a bloody shirt.
Hulahot's the one on the left, Smith offered.
Hulahot's dead? The director demanded.
Yes, sir.
Fontaine knew there would be time for explanations later. He glanced up at the thinning shields.
Agent Smith, he said slowly and clearly. The item. I need it.
Smith looked sheepish.
Sir, we still have no idea what the item is. We're on a need to know.
Chapter 114.
Then look again, Fontaine declared.
The director watched in dismay as the stilted image of the agents searched the two limp bodies in the van for a list of random numbers and letters. Jabba was pale.
Oh my God, they can't find it! We're dead!
Losing FTP filters, a voice yelled. Third shield's exposed!
There was a new flurry of activity. On the front screen, the agent with the buzz cut held out his arms in defeat.
Sir, the passkey isn't here. We've searched both men. Pockets, clothing, wallets. No sign at all. Hulahot was wearing a monocle computer, and we've checked that, too. It doesn't look like he ever transmitted anything remotely resembling random characters. Only a list of kills.
Damn it!
Fontaine seethed, suddenly losing his cool.
It's got to be there. Keep looking!
Jabba had apparently seen enough. Fontaine had gambled and lost. Jabba took over. The huge SysSec descended from his pulpit like a storm off a mountain. He swept through his army of programmers, calling out commands.
Access auxiliary kills. Start shutting it down. Do it now.
We'll never make it, Soshi yelled. We need a half hour. By the time we shut down, it'll be too late.
Jabba opened his mouth to reply, but he was cut short by a scream of agony from the back of the room. Everyone turned. Like an apparition, Susan Fletcher rose from her crouched position in the rear of the chamber. Her face was white, her eyes transfixed on the freeze frame of David Becker, motionless and bloody, propped up on the floor of the van.
You killed him! She screamed. You killed him!
She stumbled toward the image and reached out.
David!
Everyone looked up in confusion. Susan advanced, still calling, her eyes never leaving the projection of David's body.
David!
She gasped, staggering forward.
Ah, David, how could they?
Fontaine seemed lost.
You know this man?
Susan swayed unsteadily as she passed the podium. She stopped a few feet in front of the enormous projection and stared up, bewildered and numb, calling over and over to the man she loved. Chapter 115. The emptiness in David Becker's mind was absolute. I am dead. And yet there was a sound, a distant voice.
David!
There was a dizzying burning beneath his arm. His blood was filled with fire.
My body is not my own.
And yet there was a voice calling to him. It was thin, distant, but it was a part of him. There were other voices, too. Unfamiliar, unimportant, calling out. He fought to block them out. There was only one voice that mattered. It faded in and out.
David! I'm sorry.
There was a mottled light, faint at first, a single slit of grayness, growing. Becker tried to move.
Pain.
He tried to speak. Silence. The voice kept calling. Someone was near him, lifting him. Becker moved toward the voice. Or was he being moved? It was calling. He gazed absently at the illuminated image. He could see her on a small screen. It was a woman staring up at him from another world.
Is she watching me die?
David!
The voice was familiar. She was an angel. She had come for him. The angel spoke.
David, I love you.
Suddenly he knew. Susan reached out toward the screen, crying, laughing, lost in a torrent of emotions. She wiped fiercely at her tears.
David, I thought...
Field Agent Smith eased David Becker into the seat facing the monitor.
He's a little woozy, ma'am. Give him a second.
But...
Susan was stammering.
I saw a transmission... It said...
Smith nodded.
We saw it too. Hulahot counted his chickens a little early.
But the blood?
Flesh wound, Smith replied. We slapped the gauze on it. Susan couldn't speak. Agent Colliander piped in from off-camera. We hit him with the new J-23, long-acting stun gun. Probably hurt like hell, but we got him off the street.
Don't worry, ma'am, Smith assured. He'll be fine.
David Becker stared at the TV monitor in front of him. He was disoriented, lightheaded. The image on the screen was of a room filled with chaos. Susan was there. She was standing on an open patch of floor, gazing up at him. She was crying and laughing.
David, thank God! I thought I'd lost you.
He rubbed his temple. He moved in front of the screen and pulled the gooseneck microphone toward his mouth.
Susan?
Susan gazed up in wonder. David's rugged features now filled the entire wall before her. His voice boomed.
Susan, I need to ask you something.
The resonance and volume of Becker's voice seemed to momentarily suspend the action in the databank. Everyone stopped mid-stride and turned.
Susan Fletcher, the voice resonated. Will you marry me?
A hush spread across the room. A clipboard clattered to the floor along with a mug of pencils. No one bent to pick them up. There was only the faint hum of the terminal fans and the sound of David Becker's steady breathing in his microphone.
David,
Susan stammered, unaware that 37 people stood riveted behind her.
You already asked me, remember? 5 months ago. I said yes.
I know, he smiled. But this time, he extended his left hand into the camera and displayed a golden band on his fourth finger. This time I have a ring. Chapter 116.
Read it, Mr. Becker,
Fontaine ordered. Jabba sat sweating, hands poised over his keyboard.
Yes, he said. Read the blessed inscription.
Susan Fletcher stood with them, weak-kneed and aglow. Everyone in the room had stopped what they were doing and stared up at the enormous projection of David Becker. The professor twisted the ring in his fingers and studied the engraving.
And read carefully, Jabba commanded. One typo, and we're screwed.
Fontaine gave Jabba a harsh look. If there was one thing the director of the NSA knew about, it was pressure situations. Creating additional tension was never wise.
Relax, Mr. Becker. If we make a mistake, we'll re-enter the code till we get it right.
Bad advice, Mr. Becker, Jabba snapped. Get it right the first time. Kill codes usually have a penalty clause to prevent trial and error guessing. Make an incorrect entry and the cycle will probably accelerate. Make two incorrect entries and it will lock us out permanently. Game over.
The director frowned and turned back to the screen.
Mr. Becker? My mistake. Read carefully. Read extremely carefully.
Becker nodded and studied the ring for a moment. Then he calmly began reciting the inscription. Q, U, I, S, space, C. Jabba and Susan interrupted in unison.
Space?
Jabba stopped typing.
There's a space?
Becker shrugged, checking the ring. Yeah, there's a bunch of them.
Am I missing something? Fontaine demanded. What are we waiting for?
Sir, Susan said, apparently puzzled. It's just... I agree, Jabba said. It's strange. Passwords never have spaces.
Brinkerhoff swallowed hard.
So what are you saying?
He's saying, Susan interjected, that this may not be a kill code. Brinkerhoff cried out.
Of course it's the kill code. What else could it be? Why else would Tankato give it away? Who the hell inscribes a bunch of random letters on a ring?
Fontaine silenced Brinkerhoff with a sharp glare.
Folks? Becker interjected, appearing hesitant to get involved. You keep mentioning random letters. I think I should let you know. The letters on this ring aren't random.
Everyone on the podium blurted in unison.
What?
Becker looked uneasy. Sorry, but there are definitely words here. I'll admit they're inscribed pretty close together. At first glance, it appears random. But if you look closely, you'll see the inscription is actually, well, it's Latin. Jabba gaped.
You're shitting me!
Becker shook his head. No, it reads, qui custodiat ipsos custodes. It translates roughly to, who will guard the guards? Susan interrupted, finishing David's sentence. Becker did a double take. Susan, I didn't know you could...
It's from the satires of Juvenal, she exclaimed. Who will guard the guards? Who will guard the NSA while we guard the world? It was Tancato's favorite saying.
So, Midge demanded, is it the passkey or not?
It must be the passkey, Brinkerhoff declared.
Fontaine stood silent, apparently processing the information.
I don't know if it's the key, Jabba said. It seems unlikely to me that Tancato would use a non-random construction.
Just omit the spaces, Brinkerhoff cried, and type the damn code.
Fontaine turned to Susan. What's your take, Miss Fletcher? She thought a moment. She couldn't quite put her finger on it, but something didn't feel right. Susan knew Tancato well enough to know he thrived on simplicity. His proofs and programming were always crystalline and absolute. The fact that the spaces needed to be removed seemed odd. It was a minor detail, but it was a flaw. Definitely not clean. Not what Susan would have expected as Ensai Tancato's crowning blow.
It doesn't feel right, Susan finally said. I don't think it's the key.
Fontaine sucked in a long breath, his dark eyes probing hers.
Ms. Fletcher, in your mind, if this is not the key, why would Ensai Tancato have given it away? If he knew we'd murdered him, don't you assume he'd want to punish us by making the ring disappear?
A new voice interrupted the dialogue.
Director?
All eyes turned to the screen. It was Agent Colliander in Seville. He was leaning over Becker's shoulder and speaking into the mic.
For whatever it's worth, I'm not so sure Mr. Tancato knew he was being murdered.
I beg your pardon? Fontaine demanded.
Hulahot was a pro, sir. We saw the kill, only 50 meters away. All evidence suggests Tancato was unaware.
Evidence? Brinkerhoff demanded. What evidence? Tancato gave away this ring, that's proof enough.
Agent Smith, Fontaine interrupted. What makes you think Ensai Tancato was unaware he was being killed? Smith cleared his throat.
Hulahot killed him with an NTB, a non-invasive trauma bullet. It's a rubber pod that strikes the chest and spreads out. Silent. Very clean. Mr. Tancato would only have felt a sharp thump before going into cardiac arrest.
A trauma bullet, Becker mused to himself. That explains the bruising.
It's doubtful, Smith added, that Tancato associated the sensation with a gunman.
And yet he gave away his ring, Fontaine stated.
True, sir, but he never looked for his assailant. A victim always looks for his assailant when he's been shot. It's instinct.
Fontaine puzzled.
And you're saying Tancato didn't look for Hulahot?
No, sir. We have it on film, if you'd like.
X-11 filter's going, a technician yelled.
The worm's halfway there.
Forget the film, Brinkerhoff declared. Type in the damn kill code and finish this.
Jabba sighed, suddenly the cool one.
Director, if we enter the wrong code...
Yes, Susan interrupted.
If Tancato didn't suspect we killed him, we've got some questions to answer.
What's our time frame, Jabba? Fontaine demanded.
Jabba looked up at the VR.
About 20 minutes. I suggest we use the time wisely.
Fontaine was silent a long moment, then sighed heavily.
All right. Run the film.
Chapter 117.
Transmitting video in 10 seconds, Agent Smith's voice crackled. We're dropping every other frame, as well as audio. We'll run as close to real time as possible.
Everyone on the podium stood silent, watching, waiting. Jabba typed a few keys and rearranged the video wall. Tancato's message appeared on the far left. Only the truth will save you now. On the right of the wall was the static interior shot of the van with Becker and the two agents huddled around the camera. In the center, a fuzzy frame appeared. It dissolved into static and then into a black and white image of a park.
"Transmitting," Agent Smith announced.
The shot looked like an old movie. It was stilted and jerky, a byproduct of frame dropping, a process that halved the amount of information sent and enabled faster transmission. The shot panned out across an enormous concourse, enclosed on one end by a semicircular facade. The Seville Ayuntamiento. There were trees in the foreground. The park was empty.
X-11s are down, a technician called out. This bad boy's hungry.
Smith began to narrate. His commentary had the detachment of a seasoned agent.
This is shot from the van, he said, about 50 meters from the kill zone. Tancado is approaching from the right. Hulahut's in the trees to the left.
We've got a time crunch here, Fontaine pressed. Let's get to the meat of it. Agent Colliander touched a few buttons, and the frame speed increased. Everyone on the podium watched in anticipation as their former associate, Ensai Tancado, came into the frame. The accelerated video made the whole image seem comic. Tancado shuffled jerkily out onto the concourse, apparently taking in the scenery. He shielded his eyes and gazed up at the spires of the huge facade.
This is it, Smith warned. Hulahut's a pro. He took his first open shot.
Smith was right. There was a flash of light from behind the trees on the left of the screen. An instant later, Tancado clutched his chest. He staggered momentarily. The camera zoomed in on him, unstable, in and out of focus. As the footage rolled in high speed, Smith coldly continued his narration.
As you can see, Tancado is instantly in cardiac arrest.
Susan felt ill watching the images. Tancado clutched at his chest with crippled hands, a confused look of terror on his face.
You'll notice, Smith added, his eyes are focused downward at himself. Not once does he look around.
And that's important?
Jabba half stated, half inquired.
Very, Smith said. If Tancado suspected foul play of any kind, he would instinctively search the area. But as you can see, he does not.
On the screen, Tancado dropped to his knees, still clutching his chest. He never once looked up. Ensai Tancado was a man alone, dying a private, natural death.
It's odd, Smith said, puzzled. Traumapods usually won't kill this quickly. Sometimes, if the target's big enough, they don't kill at all.
Bad heart, Fontaine said flatly. Smith arched his eyebrows, impressed.
Fine choice of weapon, then.
Susan watched as Tancado toppled from his knees to his side and finally onto his back. He lay staring upward, grabbing at his chest. Suddenly, the camera wheeled away from him, back toward the grove of trees. A man appeared. He was wearing wire-rimmed glasses and carrying an oversized briefcase. As he approached the concourse and the writhing Tancado, his fingers began tapping in a strange silent dance on a mechanism attached to his hand.
He's working his monocle, Smith announced, sending a message that Tancado is terminated.
Smith turned to Becker and chuckled.
Looks like Hulahot had a bad habit of transmitting kills before his victim actually expired.
Colliander sped the film up some more, and the camera followed Hulahot as he began moving toward his victim. Suddenly, an elderly man rushed out of a nearby courtyard, ran over to Tancado, and knelt beside him. Hulahot slowed his approach. A moment later, two more people appeared from the courtyard, an obese man and a red-haired woman. They also came to Tancado's side.
Unfortunate choice of kill zone, Smith said. Hulahot thought he had the victim isolated.
On the screen, Hulahot watched for a moment and then shrank back into the trees, apparently to wait.
Here comes the handoff, Smith prompted. We didn't notice it the first time around.
Susan gazed up at the sickening image on the screen. Tancado was gasping for breath, apparently trying to communicate something to the Samaritans kneeling beside him. Then, in desperation, he thrust his left hand above him, almost hitting the old man in the face. He held the crippled appendage outward before the old man's eyes. The camera tightened on Tancado's three deformed fingers, and on one of them, clearly glistening in the Spanish sun, was the golden ring. Tancado thrust it out again. The old man recoiled. Tancado turned to the woman. He held his three deformed fingers directly in front of her face, as if begging her to understand. The ring glinted in the sun. The woman looked away. Tankato, now choking, unable to make a sound, turned to the obese man and tried one last time. The elderly man suddenly stood and dashed off, presumably to get help. Tankato seemed to be weakening, but he was still holding the ring in the fat man's face. The fat man reached out and held the dying man's wrist, supporting it. Tankato seemed to gaze upward at his own fingers, at his own ring, and then to the man's eyes. As a final plea before death, Ensai Tankato gave the man an almost imperceptible nod, as if to say, "Yes." Then Tankato fell limp.
"Jesus," Jabba moaned.
Suddenly the camera swept to where Hulahat had been hiding. The assassin was gone. A police motorcycle appeared, tearing up Avenida Ferrelli. The camera wheeled back to where Tankato was lying. The woman kneeling beside him apparently heard the police sirens. She glanced around nervously and then began pulling at her obese companion, begging him to leave. The two hurried off. The camera tightened on Tankato, his hands folded on his lifeless chest. The ring on his finger was gone. Chapter 118. "It's proof," Fontaine said decidedly. "Tankato dumped the ring. He wanted it as far from himself as possible, so we'd never find it."
"But, Director," Susan argued, "it doesn't make sense. If Tankato was unaware he'd been murdered, why would he give away the kill code?"
"I agree," Jabba said. "The kid's a rebel, but he's a rebel with a conscience. Getting us to admit to Translator is one thing. Revealing our classified data bank is another."
Fontaine stared, disbelieving. "You think Tankato wanted to stop this worm? You think his dying thoughts were for the poor NSA?
"Tunnel block corroding," a technician yelled. "Full vulnerability in 15 minutes maximum."
"I'll tell you what," the director declared, taking control. "In 15 minutes, every third world country on the planet will learn how to build an intercontinental ballistic missile. If someone in this room thinks he's got a better candidate for a kill code than this ring, I'm all ears." The director waited. No one spoke. He returned his gaze to Jabba and locked eyes. "Tankato dumped that ring for a reason, Jabba. Whether he was trying to bury it, or whether he thought the fat guy would run to a payphone and call us with the information, I really don't care. But I've made the decision. We're entering that quote. Now." Jabba took a long breath. He knew Fontaine was right. There was no better option. They were running out of time. Jabba sat.
"Okay. Let's do it."
He pulled himself to the keyboard.
"Mr. Becker? The inscription, please. Nice and easy."
David Becker read the inscription, and Jabba typed. When they were done, they double-checked the spelling and omitted all the spaces. On the center panel of the view wall, near the top, were the letters QUISCUSTODIETIPSOSCUSTODES.
"I don't like it," Susan muttered softly. "It's not clean."
Jabba hesitated, hovering over the enter key.
"Do it," Fontaine commanded.
Jabba hit the key. Seconds later, the whole room knew it was a mistake. Chapter 119.
"It's accelerating," Soshi yelled from the back of the room. "It's the wrong code."
Everyone stood in silent horror. On the screen before them was the error message. "Illegal entry. Numeric field only."
"Damn it," Jabba screamed. "Numeric only. We're looking for a goddamn number. We're fucked. This ring is shit."
"Worms at double speed," Soshi shouted. "Penalty round."
On the center screen, right beneath the error message, the VR painted a terrifying image. As the third firewall gave way, the half-dozen or so black lines representing marauding hackers surged forward, advancing relentlessly toward the core. With each passing moment, a new line appeared, then another.
"They're swarming," Soshi yelled.
Confirming overseas tie-ins, cried another technician. Word's out.
Susan averted her gaze from the image of the collapsing firewalls and turned to the side screen. The footage of Ensai Tankato's kill was on endless loop. It was the same every time. Tankato clutching his chest, falling, and with a look of desperate panic, forcing his ring on a group of unsuspecting tourists. It makes no sense, she thought. If he didn't know we'd killed him. Susan drew a total blank. It was too late. We've missed something. On the VR, the number of hackers pounding at the gates had doubled in the last few minutes. From now on, the number would increase exponentially. Hackers, like hyenas, were one big family, always eager to spread the word of a new kill. Leland Fontaine had apparently seen enough.
Shut it down, he declared. Shut the damn thing down.
Jabba stared straight ahead, like the captain of a sinking ship.
Too late, sir. We're going down.
Chapter 120. The 400-pound SysSec stood motionless, hands resting atop his head in a freeze frame of disbelief. He'd ordered a power shutdown, but it would be a good 20 minutes too late. Sharks with high-speed modems would be able to download staggering quantities of classified information in that window. Jabba was awakened from his nightmare by Soshi rushing to the podium with a new printout.
I found something, sir, she said excitedly. Orphans in the source. Alpha groupings all over the place.
Jabba was unmoved.
We're looking for a numeric, damn it, not an alpha. The kill code is a number. But we've got orphans. Tankato's too good to leave orphans, especially this many.
The term orphans referred to extra lines of programming that didn't serve the program's objective in any way. They fed nothing, referred to nothing, led nowhere, and were usually removed as part of the final debugging and compiling process. Jabba took the printout and studied it. Fontaine stood silent. Susan peered over Jabba's shoulder at the printout.
We're being attacked by a rough draft of Tankato's worm?
Polished or not, Jabba retorted, it's kicking our ass.
I don't buy it, Susan argued. Tankato was a perfectionist, you know that. There's no way he left bugs in his program.
There are lots of them, Soshi cried. She grabbed the printout from Jabba and pushed it in front of Susan.
Look!
Susan nodded. Sure enough, after every 20 or so lines of programming, there were 4 free-floating characters. Susan scanned them. P-F-E-E. S-E-S-N. R-E-T-M.
4-bit alpha groupings, she puzzled. They're definitely not part of the programming.
Forget it, Jabba growled. You're grabbing at straws.
Maybe not, Susan said. A lot of encryption uses 4-bit groupings. This could be a code.
Yeah, Jabba groaned. It says, ha ha, you're fucked. He looked up at the VR.
In about 9 minutes.
Susan ignored Jabba and locked in on Soshi.
How many orphans are there?
Soshi shrugged. She commandeered Jabba's terminal and typed all the groupings. When she was done, she pushed back from the terminal. The room looked up at the screen. P-F-E-E. S-E-S-N. R-E-T-M. M-F-H-A. And so on. Susan was the only one smiling.
Sure looks familiar, she said.
Blocks of 4. Just like Enigma. The director nodded. Enigma was history's most famous code-writing machine. The Nazis' 12-ton encryption beast. It had encrypted in blocks of 4.
Great, he moaned. You wouldn't happen to have one lying around, would you?
That's not the point, Susan said, suddenly coming to life. This was her specialty. The point is that this is a code. Tankato left us a clue. He's taunting us, daring us to figure out the passkey in time. He's laying hints just out of our reach.
Absurd, Jabba snapped.
Tankato gave us only one out. Revealing translator. That was it. That was our escape. We blew it.
I have to agree with him, Fontaine said. I doubt there's any way Tankato would risk letting us off the hook by hinting at his kill code.
Susan nodded vaguely, but she recalled how Tankato had given them N Dakota. She stared up at the letters,
wondering if he were playing another one of his games.
"Tunnel block half gone," a technician called out. On the VR, the mass of black tie-in lines surged deeper into the two remaining shields. David had been sitting quietly, watching the drama unfold on the monitor before them.
"Susan," he offered, "I have an idea. Is that text in 16 groupings of four?"
"Oh, for Christ's sake," Jabba said under his breath. "Now everyone wants to play."
Susan ignored Jabba and counted the groupings.
"Yes, 16.
"Take out the spaces," Becker said firmly.
"David," Susan replied, slightly embarrassed, "I don't think you understand. The groupings of four are..."
"Take out the spaces," he repeated. Susan hesitated a moment and then nodded to Soshi. Soshi quickly removed the spaces. The results were no more enlightening. Jabba exploded.
"Enough! Playtime's over. This thing's on double speed. We've got about 8 minutes here. We're looking for a number, not a bunch of half-baked letters."
4 by 16, David said calmly. "Do the math, Susan." Susan eyed David's image on the screen.
"Do the math? He's terrible at math."
She knew David could memorize verb conjugations and vocabulary like a Xerox machine, but math?
"Multiplication tables," Becker said. "Multiplication tables?" Susan wondered. "What is he talking about?"
4 by 16, the professor repeated. "I had to memorize multiplication tables in fourth grade." Susan pictured the standard grade school multiplication table.
4 by 16.
64, she said blankly. "So what?" David leaned toward the camera. His face filled the frame.
64 letters.
Susan nodded.
"Yes, but they're..."
Susan froze.
64 letters, David repeated.
Susan gasped.
"Oh, my God! David, you're a genius!"
Chapter 121.
7 minutes, a technician called out.
8 rows of 8, Susan shouted, excited. So she typed. Fontaine looked on silently. The second-to-last shield was growing thin.
64 letters.
Susan was in control. "It's a perfect square."
"Perfect square?" Jabba demanded. "So what?"
10 seconds later, Soshi had rearranged the seemingly random letters on the screen. They were now in 8 rows of 8. Jabba studied the letters and threw up his hands in despair. The new layout was no more revealing than the original.
"Clear as shit," Jabba groaned.
"Miss Fletcher," Fontaine demanded, "explain yourself." All eyes turned to Susan. Susan was staring up at the block of text. Gradually, she began nodding, then broke into a wide smile.
"David, I'll be damned."
Everyone on the podium exchanged baffled looks. David winked at the tiny image of Susan Fletcher on the screen before him.
64 letters. "Julius Caesar strikes again."
Midge looked lost.
"What are you talking about?"
"Caesar box," Susan beamed. "Read top to bottom. Tancato's sending us a message." Chapter 122.
6 minutes, a technician called out.
Susan shouted orders. "Retype top to bottom. Read down, not across."
Soshi furiously moved down the columns, retyping the text.
"Julius Caesar sent codes this way," Susan blurted. "His letter count was always a perfect square."
"Done," Soshi yelled.
Everyone looked up at the newly arranged single line of text on the wall screen.
"Still garbage," Jabba scoffed in disgust. "Look at it. It's totally random bits of..."
The words lodged in his throat. His eyes widened to saucers.
"Oh. Oh, my."
Fontaine had seen it, too. He arched his eyebrows, obviously impressed. Midge and Brinkerhoff both cooed in unison.
"Holy shit."
The 64 letters now read, PREMEDIFFERENCEBETWENENTSRESPONSIBLEFORHIROSHIMAKI.
"Put in the spaces," Susan ordered. "We've got a puzzle to solve."
Chapter 123. An ashen technician ran to the podium.
Tunnel block's about to go.
Jabba turned to the VR on screen. The attackers surged forward, only a whisker away from their assault on the fifth and final wall. The databank was running out of time. Susan blocked out the chaos around her. She read Tankato's bizarre message over and over. Prime difference between elements responsible for Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
It's not even a question, Brinkerhoff cried. How can it have an answer?
We need a number, Jabba reminded. The kill code is numeric.
Silence, Fontaine said evenly. He turned and addressed Susan. Miss Fletcher, you've gotten us this far. I need your best guess.
Susan took a deep breath. The kill code entry field accepts numerics only. My guess is that this is some sort of clue as to the correct number. The text mentions Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the two cities that were hit by atomic bombs. Maybe the kill code is related to the number of casualties, the estimated dollars of damage. She paused a moment, rereading the clue. The word difference seems important. The prime difference between Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Apparently, Tankato felt the two incidents differed somehow.
Fontaine's expression did not change. Nonetheless, hope was fading fast. It seemed the political backdrops surrounding the two most devastating blasts in history needed to be analyzed, compared, and translated into some magic number, and all within the next 5 minutes.
Chapter 124.
Final shield under attack!
On the VR, the PEM authorization programming was now being consumed. Black, penetrating lines engulfed the final protective shield and began forcing their way toward its core. Prowling hackers were now appearing from all over the world. The number was doubling almost every minute. Before long, anyone with a computer, foreign spies, radicals, terrorists, would have access to all of the U.S. government's classified information. As technicians tried vainly to sever power, the assembly on the podium studied the message. Even David and the two NSA agents were trying to crack the code from their van in Spain.
Prime difference between elements responsible for Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Soshi thought aloud.
The elements responsible for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Pearl Harbor? Hirohito's refusal to... We need a number, Jabba repeated. Not political theories. We're talking mathematics, not history.
Soshi fell silent.
How about payloads? Brinkerhoff offered. Casualties? Dollars damage?
We're looking for an exact figure, Susan reminded. Damage estimates vary. She stared up at the message.
The elements responsible.
3,000 miles away, David Becker's eyes flew open.
Elements, he declared. We're talking math, not history.
All heads turned toward the satellite screen.
Tankato's playing word games, Becker spouted. The word elements has multiple meanings.
Spit it out, Mr. Becker, Fontaine snapped.
He's talking about chemical elements, not sociopolitical ones.
Becker's announcement met blank looks.
Elements, he prompted. The periodic table. Chemical elements.
Didn't any of you see the movie Fat Man and Little Boy about the Manhattan Project? The two atomic bombs were different. They used different fuel. Different elements.
Soshi clapped her hands.
Yes, he's right. I read that. The two bombs used different fuels. One used uranium and one used plutonium. Two different elements.
A hush swept across the room.
Uranium and plutonium, Jabba exclaimed, suddenly hopeful. The clue asks for the difference between the two elements.
He spun to his army of workers.
The difference between uranium and plutonium. Who knows what it is?
Blank stares all around.
Come on, Jabba said. Didn't you kids go to college? Somebody, anybody. I need the difference between plutonium and uranium.
No response. Susan turned to Soshi.
I need access to the web. Is there a browser here?
Soshi nodded.
Netscape's sweetest.
Susan grabbed her hand.
Come on, we're going surfing.
Chapter 125.
How much time?
Jabba demanded from the podium. There was no response from the technicians in the back. They stood riveted, staring up at the VR. The final shield was getting dangerously thin.
Nearby, Susan and Soshi pored over the results of their web search.
Outlaw Labs? Susan asked. Who are they?
Soshi shrugged. You want me to open it?
Damn right, she said. 647 text references to uranium, plutonium, and atomic bombs. Sounds like our best bet.
Soshi opened the link. A disclaimer appeared. The information contained in this file is strictly for academic use only. Any layperson attempting to construct any of the devices described runs the risk of radiation poisoning and or self-explosion.
Self-explosion?
Soshi said.
Jesus.
Search it, Fontaine snapped over his shoulder. Let's see what we've got. Soshi plowed into the document. She scrolled past a recipe for urea nitrate, an explosive 10 times more powerful than dynamite. The information rolled by like a recipe for butterscotch brownies.
Plutonium and uranium, Jabba repeated. Let's focus.
Go back, Susan ordered. The document's too big. Find the table of contents. Soshi scrolled backward until she found it. 1. Mechanism of an atomic bomb. A. Altimeter. B. Air pressure detonator. C. Detonating heads. D. Explosive charges. E. Neutron deflector. F. Uranium and plutonium. G. Lead shield. H. Fuses. 2. Nuclear fission / nuclear fusion. A. Fission. A-bomb. And fusion. H-bomb. B. U-235, U-238, and plutonium. 3. History of the atomic weapons. A. Development, the Manhattan Project. B. Detonation. 1. Hiroshima. 2. Nagasaki. 3. Byproducts of atomic detonations. 4. Blast zones.
Section 2, Susan cried. Uranium and plutonium, go!
Everyone waited while Soshi found the right section.
This is it, she said.
Hold on.
She quickly scanned the data. There's a lot of information here. A whole chart. How do we know which difference we're looking for? One occurs naturally. One is man-made. Plutonium was first discovered by...
A number, Jabba reminded. We need a number. Susan reread Tankato's message. The prime difference between the elements. The difference between...
We need a number.
Wait, she said. The word difference has multiple meanings. We need a number, so we're talking math. It's another of Tankato's word games. Difference means subtraction.
Yes, Becker agreed from the screen overhead. Maybe the elements have different numbers of protons or something. If you subtract...
He's right, Jabba said, turning to Soshi.
Are there any numbers on that chart? Proton counts, half-lives, anything we can subtract.
3 minutes, a technician called.
How about supercritical mass? Soshi ventured. It says the supercritical mass for plutonium is 35.2 pounds.
Yes, Jabba said. Check uranium. What's the supercritical mass of uranium?
Soshi searched. 110 pounds.
110?
Jabba looked suddenly hopeful. What's 35.2 from 110?
74.8, Susan snapped. But I don't think...
Out of my way, Jabba commanded, plowing toward the keyboard. That's got to be the kill code. The difference between their critical masses, 74.8.
Hold on, Susan said, peering over Soshi's shoulder. There's more here. Atomic weights, neutron counts, extraction techniques. She skimmed the chart.
Uranium splits into barium and krypton. Plutonium does something else.
Uranium has 92 protons and 146 neutrons, but...
We need the most obvious difference, Midge chimed in. The clue reads the primary difference between the elements.
Jesus Christ, Jabba swore. How do we know what Tankato considered the primary difference?
David interrupted.
Actually, the clue reads prime, not primary. The word hit Susan right between the eyes.
Prime, she exclaimed. Prime,
she spun to Jabba. The kill code is a prime number. Think about it. It makes perfect sense. Jabba instantly knew Susan was right. Ensai Tankato had built his career on prime numbers. Primes were the fundamental building blocks of all encryption algorithms, unique values that had no factors other than one and themselves. Primes worked well in code writing because they were impossible for computers to guess using typical number tree factoring.
Soshi jumped in.
Yes, it's perfect. Primes are essential to Japanese culture. Haiku uses primes.
three lines and syllable counts of 5, 7, 5. All primes. The temples of Kyoto all have...
Enough, Jabba said. Even if the kill code is a prime, so what? There are endless possibilities.
Susan knew Jabba was right, because the number line was infinite. One could always look a little farther and find another prime number. Between 0 and 1,000,000, there were over 70,000 choices. It all depended on how large a prime Tankado decided to use. The bigger it was, the harder it was to guess.
It'll be huge, Jabba groaned. Whatever prime Tankado chose is sure to be a monster.
A call went up from the rear of the room.
2-minute warning!
Jabba gazed up at the VR in defeat. The final shield was starting to crumble. Technicians were rushing everywhere. Something in Susan told her they were close.
We can do this, she declared, taking control. Of all the differences between uranium and plutonium, I bet only one can be represented as a prime number. That's our final clue. The number we're looking for is prime.
Jabba eyed the uranium-plutonium chart on the monitor and threw up his arms.
There must be 100 entries here. There's no way we can subtract them all and check for primes.
A lot of the entries are non-numeric, Susan encouraged. We can ignore them. Uranium's natural, plutonium's man-made. Uranium uses a gun barrel detonator, plutonium uses implosion. They're not numbers, so they're irrelevant.
Do it, Fontaine ordered. On the VR, the final wall was eggshell thin.
Jabba mopped his brow.
All right, here goes nothing. Start subtracting. I'll take the top quarter. Susan, you've got the middle. Everybody else split up the rest. We're looking for a prime difference.
Within seconds, it was clear they'd never make it. The numbers were enormous, and in many cases the units didn't match up.
It's apples and goddamn oranges, Jabba said. We've got gamma rays against electromagnetic pulse, fissionable against unfissionable. Some is pure, some is percentage. It's a mess.
It's got to be here, Susan said firmly. We've got to think. There's some difference between plutonium and uranium that we're missing. Something simple.
Guys, Soshi said.
She'd created a second document window and was perusing the rest of the Outlaw Lab's document.
What is it? Fontaine demanded.
Find something?
Sort of.
She sounded uneasy.
You know how I told you the Nagasaki bomb was a plutonium bomb?
Yeah, they all replied in unison.
Well, Soshi took a deep breath. Looks like I made a mistake.
What?
Jabba choked. We've been looking for the wrong thing?
Soshi pointed to the screen. They huddled around and read the text. The common misconception that the Nagasaki bomb was a plutonium bomb. In fact, the device employed uranium, like its sister bomb in Hiroshima.
But, Susan gasped, if both elements were uranium, how are we supposed to find the difference between the two?
Maybe Tankado made a mistake, Fontaine ventured. Maybe he didn't know the bombs were the same.
No, Susan sighed. He was a cripple because of those bombs. He'd know the facts cold.
Chapter 126.
1 minute.
Jabba eyed the VR.
PEM authorization's going fast. Last line of defense. And there's a crowd at the door.
Focus, Fontaine commanded. Soshi sat in front of the web browser and read aloud.
Nagasaki bomb did not use plutonium, but rather an artificially manufactured neutron-saturated isotope of uranium-238.
Damn, Brinkerhoff swore.
Both bombs used uranium. The elements responsible for Hiroshima and Nagasaki were both uranium. There is no difference.
We're dead, Midge moaned.
Wait, Susan said. Read that last part again.
Soshi repeated the text.
Artificially manufactured, neutron-saturated isotope of uranium-238.
238? Susan exclaimed.
Didn't we just see something that said Hiroshima's bomb used some other isotope of uranium?
They all exchanged puzzled glances. Soshi frantically scrolled backward and found the spot.
Yes! It says here that the Hiroshima bomb used a different isotope of uranium.
Midge gasped in amazement.
They're both uranium, but they're different kinds.
Both uranium? Jabba muscled in and stared at the terminal.
Apples and apples. Perfect!
How are the two isotopes different? Fontaine demanded. It's got to be something basic.
Soshi scrolled through the document.
Hold on. Looking. Okay. 45 seconds, a voice called out.
Susan looked up. The final shield was almost invisible now.
Here it is, Soshi exclaimed. Read it.
Jabba was sweating.
What's the difference? There must be some difference between the two.
Yes, Soshi pointed to her monitor.
Look!
They all read the text. Two bombs employed two different fuels. Precisely identical chemical characteristics. No ordinary chemical extraction can separate the two isotopes. They are, with the exception of minute differences in weight, perfectly identical.
Atomic weight, Jabba said excitedly. That's it. The only difference is their weights. That's the key. Give me their weights. We'll subtract them.
Hold on, Soshi said, scrolling ahead.
Almost there. Yes.
Everyone scanned the text. Difference in weight, very slight. Gaseous diffusion to separate them. 10.032498X10, up arrow 134, as compared to 19.39484X10, up arrow 23, dot asterisk asterisk.
There they are, Jabba screamed. That's it. Those are the weights.
30 seconds.
Go, Fontaine whispered. Subtract them quickly.
Jabba palmed his calculator and started entering numbers.
What's the asterisk? Susan demanded. There's an asterisk after the figures.
Jabba ignored her. He was already working his calculator keys furiously.
Careful, Soshi urged. We need an exact figure. The asterisk, Susan repeated. There's a footnote.
Soshi clicked to the bottom of the paragraph. Susan read the asterisked footnote. She went white.
Oh, dear God.
Jabba looked up.
What?
They all leaned in, and there was a communal sigh of defeat. The tiny footnote read, 12% margin of error. Published figures vary from lab to lab. Chapter 127. There was a sudden and reverent silence among the group on the podium. It was as if they were watching an eclipse or a volcanic eruption. An incredible chain of events over which they had no control. Time seemed to slow to a crawl.
We're losing it, a technician cried. Tie-ins, all lines.
On the far left screen, David and Agent Smith and Colliander stared blankly into their camera. On the VR, the final firewall was only a sliver. A mass of blackness surrounded it, hundreds of lines waiting to tie in. To the right of that was Tankato. The stilted clips of his final moments ran by in an endless loop. The look of desperation, fingers stretched outward, the ring glistening in the sun. Susan watched the clip as it went in and out of focus. She stared at Tankato's eyes. They seemed filled with regret.
He never wanted it to go this far, she told herself. He wanted to save us.
And yet over and over, Tankato held his fingers outward, forcing the ring in front of people's eyes. He was trying to speak, but could not. He just kept thrusting his fingers forward. In Seville, Becker's mind still turned it over and over. He mumbled to himself.
What did they say those two isotopes were?
U-238 and U... He sighed heavily. It didn't matter. He was a language teacher, not a physicist.
Incoming lines preparing to authenticate.
Jesus! Jabba bellowed in frustration. How do the damn isotopes differ? Nobody knows how the hell they're different?
There was no response. The room full of technicians stood helplessly watching the VR. Jabba spun back to the monitor and threw up his arms.
Where's a nuclear fucking physicist when you need one?
Susan stared up at the QuickTime clip on the wall screen and knew it was over. In slow motion, she watched Tankato dying over and over. He was trying to speak, choking on his words, holding out his deformed hand, trying to communicate something.
He was trying to save the databank, Susan told herself. But we'll never know how.
Company at the door!
Jabba stared at the screen.
Here we go.
Sweat poured down his face. On the center screen, the final wisp of the last firewall had all but disappeared. The black mass of lines surrounding the core was opaque and pulsating. Midge turned away. Fontaine stood rigid, eyes front.
Brinkerhoff looked like he was about to get sick.
10 seconds.
Susan's eyes never left Tancato's image. The desperation. The regret. His hand reached out over and over, ring glistening, deformed fingers arched crookedly in strangers' faces.
He's telling them something. What is it?
On the screen overhead, David looked deep in thought.
Difference, he kept muttering to himself. Difference between U-238 and U-235. It's got to be something simple.
A technician began the countdown. 5, 4, 3. The word made it to Spain in just under a tenth of a second.
3, 3.
It was as if David Becker had been hit by the stun gun all over again. His world slowed to a stop.
3, 3, 3.
238 minus 235. The difference is 3. In slow motion, he reached for the microphone. At that very instant, Susan was staring at Tancato's outstretched hand. Suddenly, she saw past the ring, past the engraved gold, to the flesh beneath, to his fingers. 3 fingers. It was not the ring at all. It was the flesh. Tancato was not telling them, he was showing them. He was telling his secret, revealing the kill code, begging someone to understand. Praying his secret would find its way to the NSA in time.
3,
Susan whispered, stunned. 3, Becker yelled from Spain. But in the chaos, no one seemed to hear.
We're down, a technician yelled.
The VR began flashing wildly as the core succumbed to a deluge. Sirens erupted overhead.
Outbound data! High-speed tie-ins in all sectors!
Susan moved as if through a dream. She spun toward Jabba's keyboard. As she turned, her gaze fixed on her fiancé, David Becker. Again, his voice exploded overhead.
3! The difference between 235 and 238 is 3!
Everyone in the room looked up.
3!
Susan shouted over the deafening cacophony of sirens and technicians. She pointed to the screen. All eyes followed, to Tancato's hand, outstretched. 3 fingers, waving desperately in the civilian sun. Jabba went rigid.
Oh, my God!
He suddenly realized the crippled genius had been giving them the answer all the time.
3's prime, so she blurted. 3's a prime number.
Fontaine looked dazed.
Can it be that simple?
Outbound data, a technician cried. It's going fast. Everyone on the podium dove for the terminal at the same instant, a mass of outstretched hands. But through the crowd, Susan, like a shortstop stabbing a line drive, connected with her target. She typed the number 3. Everyone wheeled to the wall screen. Above the chaos, it simply read, Enter passkey? 3.
Yes, Fontaine commanded. Do it now!
Susan held her breath and lowered her finger on the enter key. The computer beeped once. Nobody moved. 3 agonizing seconds later, nothing had happened. The sirens kept going. 5 seconds. 6 seconds.
Outbound data! No change!
Suddenly, Midge began pointing wildly to the screen above.
Look!
On it, a message had materialized. Kill code confirmed.
Upload the firewalls,
Jabba ordered, but Soshi was a step ahead of him. She had already sent the command.
Outbound interrupt, a technician yelled. Tie-in severed.
On the VR overhead, the first of the 5 firewalls began reappearing. The black lines attacking the core were instantly severed.
Reinstating, Jabba cried. The damn thing's reinstating.
There was a moment of tentative disbelief, as if at any instant everything would fall apart. But then the 2nd firewall began reappearing, and then the 3rd. Moments later, the entire series of filters reappeared. The databank was secure. The room erupted. Pandemonium. Technicians hugged, tossing computer printouts in the air in celebration. Sirens wound down. Brinkerhoff grabbed Midge and held on. Soshi burst into tears.
Jabba?
Fontaine demanded. How much did they get?
Very little,
Jabba said, studying his monitor.
Very little. And nothing complete.
Fontaine nodded slowly, a wry smile forming in the corner of his mouth.
He looked around for Susan Fletcher, but she was already walking toward the front of the room. On the wall before her, David Becker's face filled the screen.
David?
Hey, gorgeous, he smiled.
Come home, she said. Come home right now.
Meet you at Stone Manor? He asked. She nodded, the tears welling.
Deal.
Agent Smith? Fontaine called. Smith appeared on screen behind Becker.
Yes, sir.
It appears Mr. Becker has a date. Could you see that he gets home immediately? Smith nodded.
Our jet's in Malaga.
He patted Becker on the back.
You're in for a treat, Professor. Ever flown in a Learjet 60?
Becker chuckled. Not since yesterday. Chapter 128. When Susan awoke, the sun was shining. The soft rays sifted through the curtains and filtered across her goose-down feather bed. She reached for David.
Am I dreaming?
Her body remained motionless, spent, still dizzy from the night before.
David,
she moaned. There was no reply. She opened her eyes, her skin still tingling. The mattress on the other side of the bed was cold. David was gone.
I'm dreaming, Susan thought.
She sat up. The room was Victorian, all lace and antiques, Stone Manor's finest suite. Her overnight bag was in the middle of the hardwood floor, her lingerie on a Queen Anne chair beside the bed.
Had David really arrived?
She had memories, his body against hers, his waking her with soft kisses.
Had she dreamed at all?
She turned to the bedside table. There was an empty bottle of champagne, two glasses, and a note. Rubbing the sleep from her eyes, Susan drew the comforter around her naked body and read the message. Dearest Susan, I love you. Without wax. David. She beamed and pulled the note to her chest. It was David, all right. Without wax. It was the one code she had yet to break. Something stirred in the corner, and Susan looked up. On a plush divan, basking in the morning sun, wrapped in thick bathrobe, David Becker sat quietly watching her. She reached out, beckoning him to come to her.
Without wax? She cooed, taking him in her arms.
Without wax, he smiled. She kissed him deeply.
Tell me what it means.
No chance, he laughed. A couple needs secrets. It keeps things interesting. Susan smiled coyly.
Any more interesting than last night, and I'll never walk again.
David took her in his arms. He felt weightless. He had almost died yesterday, and yet here he was, as alive as he had ever felt in his life. Susan lay with her head on his chest, listening to the beat of his heart. She couldn't believe that she had thought he was gone forever.
David,
she sighed, eyeing the note beside the table.
Tell me about without wax. You know I hate codes I can't break.
David was silent.
Tell me, Susan pouted, or you'll never have me again.
Liar. Susan hit him with a pillow.
Tell me now.
But David knew he would never tell. The secret behind without wax was too sweet. Its origins were ancient. During the Renaissance, Spanish sculptors who made mistakes while carving expensive marble often patched their flaws with cera, wax. A statue that had no flaws and required no patching was hailed as a sculpture sincera, or a sculpture without wax. The phrase eventually came to mean anything honest or true. The English word sincere evolved from the Spanish sincera, without wax. David's secret code was no great mystery. He was simply signing his letters sincerely. Somehow, he suspected Susan would not be amused. You'll be pleased to know, David said, attempting to change the subject, that during the flight home, I called the president of the university. Susan looked up, hopeful.
Tell me you resigned as department chair.
David nodded. I'll be back in the classroom next semester. She sighed in relief.
right where you belonged in the first place.
David smiled softly. Yeah, I guess Spain reminded me what's important.
Back to breaking co-ed's hearts?
Susan kissed his cheek.
Well, at least you'll have time to help me edit my manuscript.
Manuscript?
Yes, I've decided to publish.
Publish?
David looked doubtful.
Publish what?
Some ideas I have on variant filter protocols and quadratic residues.
He groaned. Sounds like a real bestseller.
She laughed. You'd be surprised.
David fished inside the pocket of his bathrobe and pulled out a small object.
Close your eyes.
I have something for you.
Susan closed her eyes. Let me guess, a gaudy gold ring with Latin all over it?
No, David chuckled. I had Fontaine return that to Ensai Tancado's estate.
He took Susan's hand and slipped something onto her finger.
Liar,
Susan laughed, opening her eyes. I knew...
But Susan stopped short. The ring on her finger was not Tancado's at all. It was a platinum setting that held a glittering diamond solitaire.
Susan gasped.
David looked her in the eye.
Will you marry me?
Susan's breath caught in her throat. She looked at him, and then back to the ring. Her eyes suddenly welled up.
Oh, David, I don't know what to say.
Say yes. Susan turned away and didn't say a word. David waited.
Susan Fletcher, I love you. Marry me.
She lifted her head. Her eyes were filled with tears.
I'm sorry, David, she whispered. I can't.
David stared in shock. He searched her eyes for the playful glimmer he'd come to expect from her. It wasn't there.
Susan, he stammered, I don't understand. I can't, she repeated. I can't marry you.
She turned away. Her shoulders started trembling. She covered her face with her hands. David was bewildered.
But Susan, I thought...
He held her trembling shoulders and turned her body toward him. It was then that he understood. Susan Fletcher was not crying at all. She was in hysterics.
I won't marry you, she laughed, attacking again with the pillow. Not until you explain without wax. You're driving me crazy.
Epilogue. They say in death, all things become clear. Tokugen Numataka now knew it was true. Standing over the casket in the Osaka customs office, he felt a bitter clarity he had never known. His religion spoke of circles, of the interconnectedness of life. But Numataka had never had time for religion. The customs officials had given him an envelope of adoption papers and birth records.
You are this boy's only living relative, they had said. We had a hard time finding you.
Numataka's mind reeled back 32 years to that rain-soaked night, to the hospital ward where he had deserted his deformed child and dying wife. He had done it in the name of Menboku, honor. An empty shadow now. There was a golden ring enclosed with the papers. It was engraved with words Numataka did not understand. It made no difference. Words had no meaning for Numataka anymore. He had forsaken his only son. And now, the cruelest of fates had reunited them. This is Paul Michael. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Digital Fortress by Dan Brown. To find out more about the complete Books on Tape catalog of unabridged audiobooks, call our customer service department at the number on this package or visit us online at booksontape.com. Digital Fortress by Dan Brown. Copyright 1998 by Dan Brown. Published by arrangement with St. Martin's Press, LLC. Production copyright 2003, Books on Tape, Incorporated.